Arliss Perry came from a conservative family and was a devout Christian. She had recently married Bruce Perry, her former high school sweetheart, and at the time, a student at Stanford University in California. For the first time in her life, she left her hometown of Bismarck, North Dakota, and moved into a dorm for married couples in Palo Alto, California. Here, she lived with her new husband, and while he pursued a career in mental health, she explored her new world. The transition was hard for a conservative Midwestern woman living now in a much more liberal California in 1974. She was lonely, and while her husband toiled away at his studies or at his job, she longed desperately for the family and friends she had left behind. In countless letters and phone calls, she expressed this sadness and discussed her frustration with being so isolated in a new place. Things began to turn around for Arliss, though, and in the fall of 1974, she found work as a receptionist for a law firm. Her communications back home became much more positive, and the lovely young bride seemed to have finally found a silver lining in all of the storm clouds. Arliss was excited for the future, and felt that things were finally getting back on track. She and Bruce enjoyed their new home, and the more they settled in, the more they felt like it was where they belonged. On a late October night, Arliss decided to walk across the Stanford campus to mail some letters. Bruce decided he would accompany her, as the area wasn't the safest to be walking alone for a woman at that time of night. There had been violent acts in recent years, and Bruce wanted to ensure the safety of his wife. Close to midnight, the couple got into an argument, and Arliss decided to walk on by herself. She planned to go to the Stanford Memorial Church to pray and to clear her mind. She told her husband that she would return soon. Neither of them knew that this would be the last time they would ever speak. As the night grew longer and Arliss failed to return home, Bruce began searching for her, and when he could find nothing, he contacted the police and reported his wife missing. At 5:45 a.m. on October 12, 1974, the body of Arliss Perry was discovered inside the Stanford Memorial Church. She had been beaten, strangled, and murdered. If that wasn't terrible enough, her body had been posed in a disturbing fashion, and the killer had desecrated Arliss and the church itself. For 43 years, investigators have been both baffled by the motive and haunted by the scene they came upon. Theories have been put forth, some realistic and others fantastical. Was Arliss a victim of the Son of Sam? Did a satanic cult strike out against her for trying to convert their members? Was it the work of the notorious Zodiac Killer, or did a complete stranger commit a random act of horrific violence? Perhaps the same man who had been seen arguing with Arliss at her job the day before she was murdered. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 10, The Bizarre Murder of Arliss Perry. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode focuses on the bizarre murder of Arliss Perry on the Stanford University campus in 1974. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and can be found on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and more. I've recently launched a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on our official website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, tweet me at TraceEvPod, that's TraceEvPod on Twitter, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on our website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it becomes to find the podcast and the more attention can be given to these cases. Today, we look into the murder of Arliss Perry. As a warning, This episode does involve some graphic content in terms of the crime scene, but I've done my best to remain respectful of the victim and tame in my descriptions. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 10, The Bizarre Murder of Arliss Perry. Arliss K. Dykema was born on February 22, 1955, in Bismarck, North Dakota. She attended Bismarck High School, where she was involved in many school activities and organizations. Arliss was a devout Christian, and during her time at Bismarck, she met her future husband, Bruce Perry. Arliss was described as an optimistic woman who saw the bright side in everything. She was kind, caring, and compassionate. She was also described as being very trusting, and this was perhaps due to her sheltered upbringing. She spent much of her life living in Bismarck and had never ventured beyond its borders. Her father, Marvin Dykema, when asked about Arliss, said, quote, "She had never been away from home before. She trusted everybody. That was the whole problem right there," end quote. After graduating from Bismarck High School, Bruce moved across the country to attend Stanford University, pursuing a career as a doctor. Arliss still had a year left in high school, and it's been reported that during this time, while Bruce was away, Arliss spent her time spreading the gospel and proselytizing to non-believers. One of the groups that Arliss allegedly approached and attempted to convert was the Process Church. The full name of the group is the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Established in London in 1966 by Marianne McLean and Robert de Grimston Moore, two former Scientologists who had been expelled from the Church of Scientology. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, the process, as it's often called, began to spread into the United States. Some have defined it as a satanic cult, and others have called it a new religious movement. Over the years, the process was suggested to have been linked to several crimes. Alleged cult-like activity and satanic ritual led authorities to initially linking the process to the Manson family and the shocking Tate-LaBianca murders. However, as the years progressed, no specified evidence could be discovered which made a direct connection between the two groups. During questioning, Charles Manson was asked if he knew the process and if he knew co-founder Robert de Grimston Moore, to which Manson responded, quote, "You're looking at him. Moore and I are one and the same," end quote. Members of the process visited the district attorney and emphatically denied that the group had any involvement in the murders. Some have separated the process from what is currently defined as Satanism, as it has no direct ties to the teachings of Anton LaVey, founder of the Church of Satan, and if anything, defined the religion as its own breed. The process began to fade in the 1970s, and by the mid-70s, it was all but disbanded. The group has been accused of having links to both David Berkowitz, who in the mid-1970s would commit six murders, coming to be known as the 44 caliber killer, and later, as the Son of Sam, as well as connections to the elusive Zodiac Killer. Arliss continued her relationship with Bruce from a distance. Brad King, a dentist in Bismarck who had attended high school with both Arliss and Bruce, defined their relationship as a pure example of, quote, "young love," end quote. Arliss attended Bismarck Junior College, and in August of 1974, she and Bruce were married. Shortly after the ceremony, Arliss packed up to leave Bismarck for the first time, heading to Palo Alto, California, where she would live with Bruce while he attended Stanford. Arliss reportedly loved her new surroundings and would take long walks around the Stanford campus. Several times, Arliss took her walks around campus at night, but Bruce advised against this. He was worried about her walking at night by herself and told her to constrain her walks to the daytime. Despite her love for the new area, Arliss felt somewhat alone. Bruce was busy with his studies as well as working at a job to support the couple. Arliss wrote letters home to friends and family, explaining that the area was lovely, but she had a difficult time making friends. The newlyweds lived in a dorm specifically designated for married couples, and in order to alleviate some of her loneliness and to help support them, Arliss began looking for a job. Not long after she began looking, Arliss got a job as a receptionist at the Spaeth, Blase, Valentine, and Klein law firm. On October 11th, 1974, Arliss received a strange visitor at work. At the time, her coworkers believed the visitor to be her husband, but this was later proven to not be the case. The man was described as being in his early 20s, standing 5'10" tall. He had curly blonde hair, and was dressed in jeans and a plaid shirt. Co-workers later stated that the visit seemed to shake Arliss, and she was visibly upset after the man left. To this day, the identity of this mystery visitor has never been ascertained. The next night, on October 12th, Arliss needed to mail some letters and was going to take a walk across the Stanford campus to a nearby postal drop box. Bruce decided to tag along with his wife, and the two left the dorm around 11:30 p.m. Somewhere along the way, the couple got into an argument, reportedly about their car's tire air pressure. Arliss is alleged to have told Bruce that she wanted some time alone and walked off. This would be the last time that Bruce would ever see his wife alive. Bruce later said that Arliss was going to take a walk over to the Stanford Memorial Church, where she planned to pray and calm herself. Arliss left Bruce at approximately 11:50 p.m. Arliss was spotted by Stephen Crawford, a security guard, entering the church just prior to midnight. Two witnesses exited the church shortly after Arliss arrived, and they also reported an unidentified male entering not long after Arliss did. Shortly after Crawford saw Arliss, he checked the church and found it vacant. According to Crawford, he shouted into the church, informing anyone who might be inside that the church was closing for the night and they needed to leave before he locked up. No one responded, and no one came forward. Crawford would claim he looked through the church, making sure no one was inside at this time. It's somewhat difficult to swallow this, as authorities would later state that there were indeed at least two individuals inside the church at this time, one of them being Arliss, and the other the unidentified person who would later murder her. As was his normal routine, Crawford then locked the church for the night and walked away. The Stanford Memorial Church is located on the main quad of Stanford University. The church began being built in 1898 and was dedicated in 1903. It was built in a Romanesque style inspired by churches in Venice. It's adorned with large stained glass windows and mosaics based on religious paintings. It's a multi-denominational church, and Arliss often referred to it as, quote-unquote, oh-so-beautiful. It was a place of comfort for Arliss, who found it a picturesque location to explore her faith. Bruce arrived home and waited for Arliss. He began to become worried when, as the hours passed, she failed to walk through the door. He got into their car and began driving around campus looking for her. When he didn't see her anywhere, he went by the church. Bruce attempted to enter the church, but found the doors locked. Assuming that he must have missed her, he drove back home, but Arliss still wasn't there. When 3 a.m. arrived, and Arliss still had not come back, Bruce could no longer contain his concern, and he contacted the police to report her missing. Police responded to the call, and when Bruce explained the evening's events to them, they too went to the church. When police arrived, the church was still locked, and they felt that she must have run into trouble somewhere between the church and the dorm on her walk back. At approximately 5:45 a.m., Stephen Crawford, the security guard, returned to the church to unlock it for the day. Much to his surprise, he found one of the church doors unlocked. Later investigation would show that the door had been forced open from the inside. It was then that Crawford made a grisly discovery. According to Crawford, as he entered, he found Arliss Perry's body. According to reports of the time, quote, police said she was on her back, spread-eagled, in the church's east transept. Her jeans and underwear were off, and two 24-inch altar candles had been used to sexually assault her, end quote. One candle, described as possibly being as long as 30 inches, was still partially inside of her when her body was found. Police were able to ascertain the cause of death relatively quickly. The handle of an ice pick was seen protruding from Arliss's head, just behind her left ear. The blade of the pick was 5.5 inches long and had been jammed into her skull. Police believe that the presence of the ice pick shows premeditation, as most people do not carry an ice pick with them to a church in the middle of the night. That being said, the question becomes, was this a random crime, or did someone expect Arliss to arrive at the church that night? The answer to that question cannot be known for sure. Despite the candles being used as devices for sexual assault, there was no evidence that Arliss had been defiled by the killer himself. There were no signs of forced intercourse, although a kneeling pillow found next to the body did have traces of semen on it. There are some different descriptions of the scene, with many accounts saying that the body was found partially under a church pew, nude from the waist down, with her legs spread apart, and in addition to the candle that had been used to sexually assault her, a second candle was found pushed up between her breasts. In yet another variation, it is said that her body was in fact discovered on the central altar of the church, and that police themselves moved her body to beside a pew in order to retain the sanctity of the church and reduce the desecration. Interestingly, some accounts report that Arliss's jeans were open and spread out, with the bottoms touching her calves. It's been said that from a bird's eye view of the crime scene, Arliss's legs and the inverted jeans made a diamond shape, and it's believed that this imagery was done on purpose. Some believe that the shape being attempted was not a diamond, but a pentagram, although it's purely speculative. It's also stated that Arliss's blouse was torn open, and her arms were folded across her chest. It has been said that in addition to the ice pick, Arliss was violently beaten and partially choked. Regardless of which variation is more accurate, it was without debate that Arliss had been attacked and murdered by a vicious killer. The motive for the murder would become hotly debated in the press, as well as within the police department itself. Investigation of the scene found a palm print on one of the candles, in addition to the semen on the pillow. Further investigation revealed that 7 different people had entered and exited the church that evening, in addition to Arliss. One of the men who entered the church was never identified for certain. The 2 witnesses who exited the church shortly after Arliss arrived described him as being approximately 5'10" tall and of medium build with sandy hair. Interestingly, this description fits that of the unknown man who visited Arliss at her job the day before she was murdered. Police closely scrutinized and investigated both security guard Stephen Crawford, who had discovered the body, as well as Arliss's husband, Bruce Perry. The police went to notify Bruce of their discovery, and when they knocked on his door, he answered and they noted that he was covered in blood. Bruce would claim that the blood was his own, and that he got severe nosebleeds when heavily stressed. He immediately became a key suspect in the minds of the police. When investigating, the evidence found at the scene did not match either Perry or Crawford. A blood typing was done, and it was Bruce's blood type on his clothes and not that of Arliss. Also, Bruce submitted to a polygraph test, which he reportedly passed without incident. Based on the evidence and investigation, both men were cleared of involvement in the crime. Initial theories involved the possibility that Perry had been murdered after rebuffing her killer's sexual advances, and that the scene had been staged in response to that rejection. Others took the point of view that the staging of her body was some part of a satanic sacrifice, or was at least ritualistic in nature. Some have even tried to link her murder to the Freemasons. There were connections alleged to the Son of Sam, accusations against the Process Church, and even theories that this had been perpetrated by the famed Zodiac Killer. One theory calls back to Arliss's last year in Bismarck, and it has been supposed that during her time trying to convert members of the Process Church, she angered one of its leaders, and he followed her to Palo Alto with the intention of stalking and murdering her. An autopsy was conducted on Arliss, and it was determined that her time of death was approximately 12 a.m. This is a disturbing piece of information for several reasons. Stephen Crawford was locking the church up at this time, which means that it's incredibly likely that Arliss was already lying dead inside the church when he locked the doors. This also adds a great deal of doubt to the idea that he thoroughly looked through the church before locking it up. In addition, the police arrived shortly after 3 a.m. to check for Arliss, and found all of the doors to the church locked, and that it appeared vacant. Since Crawford finds a door open at 5:45 a.m., this would mean that the murderer was still inside of the church when police were outside. He could have been posing her body during this time, masturbating and leaving his semen behind on the pillow, or perhaps even just looking at the horrible thing he had done. Either way, it appears that the killer didn't vacate the premises until sometime between 3 a.m. and 5:45 a.m. Police did not initially release too many details about the murder. They wanted to keep the description of the scene itself under wraps for investigative purposes. Police will often withhold details of a case in order to verify information from suspects or to use those details in interrogation. Santa Clara police took this very seriously and tried to maintain control over the flow of information. Rumor and speculation began to arise, and questions were raised regarding a possible cult or ritualistic link to the murder. In response, Undersheriff Tom Rosa stated, quote, "It has no cult-like overtones. It just happened to occur in a church," end quote. For what most people knew at the time, Arliss Perry had been murdered in the Stanford Memorial Church, but that was about all they knew. In the time since, it has also been reported that the killer took two particular items from Arliss's body that night, perhaps as proof of what he did, or as trophies. On October 15th, a memorial service was held for Arliss in Stanford Memorial Church, the site of her murder. Reportedly, not many people attended the service. Arliss had not had the time to meet many people, although several employees of the law firm where she had begun working a few weeks earlier did attend. It was at this memorial service where one of her co-workers was surprised when he met Arliss's husband, Bruce. The co-worker recounted the story of the man who had come into the office the day before Arliss's murder. According to him, Arliss and the man got in some kind of argument, and when the man left, Arliss was upset. He apologized to Bruce and explained to him that since Arliss was a new employee and they didn't know her very well, they had all previously assumed that the man she was arguing with had been her husband. Shortly after the memorial service, Arliss's body was sent back home to Bismarck, North Dakota. Her family and friends held a funeral for her there, but still at this point in time, none of them knew the exact details of how she was murdered. According to her obituary, Arliss left behind her husband, parents, a brother and sister, and her grandparents. The service was sorrowful, but for the conservative Christian family, it was also a time to celebrate her life and her moving on to heaven. When asked about the unsolved murder of her daughter, Arliss's mother, Jean Dykema, was quoted as saying, "I guess I would like to see it solved, but there's somebody greater than us that's going to punish that person. We don't have to worry about that, and it won't bring her back." End quote. Sometime after the funeral, there was a temporary marker erected as they waited for delivery of Arliss's tombstone. Allegedly, within days of the service, someone entered the cemetery and stole the temporary marker. Some people have pointed to this act as being linked to the theory that Arliss fell victim to someone who had tracked her from North Dakota to California. Others brush it aside and chalk it up to troublesome teenagers out causing a ruckus. Over the next 43 years, not much changed in terms of the status of the case. Bruce Perry, Arliss's widower, went on to become a world-renowned mental health practitioner focusing on trauma in children, and was even called in following the incident with the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. He offered treatment and services to the children involved. Since the time of her murder, Arliss has remained in the thoughts of the Santa Clara Sheriff's Department, who still list the case as open and unsolved. Many theories would be purported over the years, and suspects would be shuffled in and out of consideration for having perpetrated this heinous crime. I must admit, the so-called rabbit hole goes quite deep when it comes to theories about this case. Theories span the gamut from totally logical to oddly fantastical, but in the interest of full disclosure, and in order to give this case the attention it deserves, I will touch on many of the major theories. In 2016, a new witness would come forward with an account of what allegedly occurred in the Stanford Memorial Church the night Arliss Perry was murdered. His story would discuss a possible suspect and an alleged link to the notorious killer, David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam. 64-year-old Brian McCracken came forward to police and told them what he saw and experienced the night of Arliss's murder. According to McCracken, he left a coffee shop and was walking past the church at approximately midnight. He claims to have heard what he described as strange flute music coming from the church, and being curious, he chose to investigate. McCracken states that he entered the church and, quote, "This guy is up at the lectern, a young, skinny white guy, and he has on an afro wig, a light-colored large afro wig. It looked very striking, and he's playing the flute, a large silver flute. To the right of him on the altar was this nude girl lying there. She had candlesticks burning, one on either side of her. As I walked down the aisle, he looked at me. He doesn't seem happy to see me. And then she's lying flat on the altar, and she's looking straight up to the top of the church. She turns her head to the left and smiles. By this time, I'm within 20 feet of the flutist and her on the altar. I had the feeling that there was no danger to this girl. It didn't look serious. The girl looked comfortable." End quote. According to McCracken, the man gave him a quote-unquote menacing look, which made him feel like whatever was going on there, he wasn't invited. At that point, McCracken left and never thought about it much again. He felt the two were involved in some kind of a black mass, devil-worshipping kind of game or reenactment, and that there wasn't much more to it than two people screwing around and acting ridiculous in a church late at night. McCracken would say he didn't speak to police about what he saw, and that he only recalls seeing one story about the murder in the papers. He reportedly had a very busy travel schedule for his business, and didn't give the incident much thought after the fact. Around 2011, McCracken was having a conversation with a local police officer who was retiring. They got on the subject of weird things the officer had seen while on the job, and according to McCracken, this jogged his memory about what he had seen in the church that night. He informed the police officer about the strange incident, and was told that the crime which occurred that night had never been solved. It was at this point that McCracken put it all together, and realized that he may have seen Arliss and her murderer in the church that night. McCracken would claim that this wasn't the only time he'd seen the man with the flute. According to McCracken, he had seen this unidentified man as part of the Stanford Marching Band. McCracken began researching the man, and was able to ascertain his name. He arranged to meet with the Santa Clara police, and in a recorded interview with Sergeant Herman Leon and retired detective-turned-private investigator Randy Bynum, he told the story and gave all the information he had. This meeting took place on December 15, 2011, in Morgan Hill, California, at a local Chili's restaurant. Interested in what he had to say, and thinking that this may be the first viable lead in the case, investigators were drawn in, but wanted some way to confirm his story. That opportunity came in February of 2012, when Bynum asked McCracken to go along with him and pose as a pair of reporters who would get an interview with the man, using this as a way to ask him questions about his past and to gain any details they could in regard to his whereabouts and activities during the early part of October 1974. During this interview, it's alleged that the musician admitted to tossing away the Afro wig he used to wear while he was in the Stanford Marching Band. The very Afro wig which McCracken had reported to have seen him wearing that night in the church. By the end of the interview, McCracken felt vindicated, stating that the discussion of the Afro was, quote, confirmation to me that he was the guy I saw at the church with the girl lying naked on the altar, end quote. McCracken would later say that the girl looked very similar to a photo of Arliss Perry. The man being interviewed, though, began to feel uneasy, and expressed his disinterest in ever returning to California. According to McCracken, the man, quote, said specifically that he would never come back to California to perform again, end quote. When asked about this, James Jensen, a spokesman for the Santa Clara Sheriff's Department, stated, quote, at this point, we are leaning toward him as not being a suspect. Investigators followed up on all leads and fully investigated McCracken's claims. If DNA evidence comes along, we will reevaluate the case, end quote. Mr. Jensen would not confirm whether or not the Sheriff's Department had gained any new information from the musician, nor if they had even interviewed him in the first place. When the press reached out in response to this, the musician stated, quote, I've never been involved on anything criminal in my entire life. I've been very lucky that way, end quote. Despite my sincerest efforts, I've been unable to locate the full name of the musician, but at this point, he's not considered a suspect, and other than McCracken's account, no other persons nor evidence has come to light to support his claims about that night in Palo Alto. Another theory, which has caught fire in the years since the murder, is that David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, was involved with the murder in some way. In a Stanford Daily article published on November 29, 1984, it is stated that, quote, police have established theories which link the murder to both New York Son of Sam killer and a satanic cult in North Dakota, end quote. The article reveals some new details about the case, and shines a light on the alleged connection between the Son of Sam and the satanic cult. According to the article, quote, based on autopsy reports, police characterized the killer as a sexual psychopath. Physical evidence, candles, perhaps the murder weapon, and other articles bearing fingerprints were sent to the FBI for tests. Santa Clara Sheriff's Captain Frank Masonic, chief of detectives, called this evidence, quote, the key to the case, end quote. The article further states that there were over 125 fingerprints retrieved from objects found in association with Arliss's body, and that a composite drawing had been developed based on the statements of witnesses in and around the church that night. Reportedly, the sheriff's department managed to track down and interview the man who was depicted in the composite. But through evidence comparison and interrogation, the suspect was ultimately cleared of involvement. If this is true, and the composite does indeed represent the man who both visited Arliss at work and was seen in the vicinity of the church, if this is the same man in both instances, then the prime suspect in the case at the time it occurred has been officially cleared. All of this changed, though, in 1979, some 5 years after the murder took place. Allegedly, Felix Gilroy, a legal aid attorney, suggested a possible link between David Berkowitz and the murder. In addition to these statements from Gilroy, police came into possession of a book about witchcraft which had been written in. The writing is claimed to be that of David Berkowitz, and it reads as follows, quote, Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked, and slain, followed to California, Stanford University, end quote. According to testimony, prior to committing his own series of murders, Berkowitz had joined a satanic cult in Minot, North Dakota. Minot is 110 miles away from Perry's hometown of Bismarck. Berkowitz was questioned by police and stated that he had been present at a meeting in which a member of this satanic group claimed that he was responsible for the death of Arliss Perry. There's a set of files written by Sergeant Kahn of the San Jose Police Department about an interview he conducted with David Berkowitz. This interview took place on December 3rd, 1979. According to the files, quote, during the interview with Berkowitz, he advised that the only information he had concerning the Arliss Perry murder is from what he had read in newspaper articles sent to him by an individual named D. Channel. However, later Berkowitz stated that he had heard about the murder from someone else. Berkowitz denied being involved in the Arliss Perry murder, end quote. It was at this point that the police began questioning Berkowitz in regard to his possible involvement with a satanic group in Minot, North Dakota. According to the report, quote, Berkowitz denied being involved in any such group. However, it appeared to us that he did have considerable knowledge of the occult activities. Berkowitz became very nervous during the interview, and when we asked him whether or not he talked to the individual who allegedly killed Arliss Perry, Berkowitz evaded answering the question and would neither confirm nor deny having this knowledge, end quote. Shortly after this line of questioning began, Berkowitz revealed he was concerned about being labeled a snitch. Allegedly, he felt that he had talked to the police for around 30 minutes, and if he were to stay longer, other prisoners would think he was an informant and he would be in danger. He spoke about being concerned for the safety of his living family members and wanting to go back to his cell. In conclusion, the report reads, quote, it was learned that the anonymous newspaper clipping sent to the Santa Clara Sheriff's Office from New Orleans had been mailed by D. Channel, end quote. In a phone interview with the Stanford Daily, Tom Beck, another officer from San Jose who was present during the questioning of Berkowitz, tells the newspaper that he and his partner do not believe Berkowitz was responsible for the murder, but they do believe he knows who was. Captain Raul Niemeyer of the Stanford Police Department disagrees. In relation to the Berkowitz interview, Niemeyer stated, quote, I frankly don't believe it. Berkowitz liked to play games, end quote. Contrarily, Captain Masonic of the Santa Clara Sheriff's Department, when asked about Berkowitz, stated that he thinks he, quote, probably has some knowledge, end quote. Unfortunately, these leads appear to have gone nowhere. When asked for the status of the case, Niemeyer explained that they have a set of prints, and once they found the man who went with them, they would have the killer. Asked if they were closer now to solving the case than they were when it first happened, Niemeyer responded, quote, we are probably further away. We try to solve a case within the first 48 hours, end quote. Maury Terry, a former reporter, wrote a book titled The Ultimate Evil, which examines possible cult connections to the murder of Arliss Perry. In his book, Terry claims that the Book of Witchcraft, which David Berkowitz allegedly wrote on, was mailed to the Bismarck police by Berkowitz himself. And rather than being a mundane book on witchcraft, it's a book about practicing witchcraft, which is used by the Process Church. In 1997, 20 years after his confession to the Son of Sam murders, Berkowitz began to put forth a theory that he was only one of several people involved in the crime. He would claim that he had gone to Untermeyer Park in Yonkers, New York, where there would be people getting high and conducting occult rituals in which he became involved. Berkowitz would state that the group was involved in animal sacrifice and the use of child pornography. Berkowitz would claim he was off on the scout or lookout while the shootings took place and others had pulled the trigger. Another piece of evidence which is often used to link Arliss's murder to Satanism is the date of the murder. October 12th in satanic culture is a highly celebrated day. It's the birthday of Aleister Crowley, and typically referred to as Crowley Mass. Crowley is often referred to as, quote, the wickedest man in the world, end quote, and is a very well-known name among Satanists and black magic practitioners. Berkowitz points to two brothers, John and Michael Carr, as being the triggermen. Michael Carr died in a traffic accident several years after the Son of Sam murders. His brother John, interestingly enough, died of gunshot wounds he received in 1978 in North Dakota. According to Maury Terry, the author and the man who conducted the 1997 interview with David Berkowitz, the murder of Arliss Perry connects back to the Process Church in North Dakota, and the claims that Arliss had gone there to try and convert members to Christianity. Terry would claim that David Berkowitz knew the killer, who he would never name, but who he referred to as Manson II. Manson II is alleged to be a man named William Menser, a contract killer with ties to drug cartels and satanic cults. He was in prison for two murders and is sentenced to life. He has long been suspected of having some involvement in the Son of Sam murders, as well as being a, quote, spiritual hitman, end quote, for the Process Church. Due to Berkowitz's statements and Menser's killings, many have considered this a confirmation that the Process Church sent Menser to commit the murder of Arliss Perry. Evidence appears to end at this point, though. Menser was looked at for the murders, but police have had little to say in regard to a possible link between Menser and Arliss Perry. Interestingly enough, William Menser brings in another theory. This theory is that the elusive Zodiac killer who terrorized California during the late 1960s may have been the one responsible for the murder of Arliss Perry. Some people have even gone so far as to link the two theories, saying that Menser himself is the true identity of the Zodiac. The links between Zodiac and Arliss Perry are very circumstantial and require a fairly open mind to believe. According to the theory, in January of 1974, Zodiac sends a letter known as the Exorcist Letter. In this letter, Zodiac writes, quote, "I saw and think The Exorcist was the best satirical comedy I have ever seen," end quote. The letter is believed to have been sent from San Mateo, California. In the January 12, 1974 edition of the San Mateo Times, there's a report that a man claiming to be the Zodiac placed a phone call to the police and informed them that he has killed a woman and her body can be found in a church. Reportedly, police check local churches, but nothing is ever found. 9 months later to the day, on October 12, 1974, Arliss Perry is murdered in the Stanford Memorial Church. Although many people believe it's purely coincidental or speculative, there is a strange link between the phone call, the letter, and the crime. In the film The Exorcist, there's a scene in which the little girl who is possessed violently inserts a crucifix into herself. Many people have drawn parallels between this scene in the film, the letter written by Zodiac, and the fact that Arliss Perry had a candle inserted into her before or after being murdered in a church. Some people have gone further, claiming that William Menser himself is the Zodiac. But outside of the fact that he vaguely resembles the composite drawing, there's little else which links him to Zodiac or Zodiac to Arliss Perry. It's a theory, and it's often discussed, but to say it is thin is to give a great deal of credit to the theory. It's nearly invisible. It's certainly possible that Zodiac could have been involved, but when it comes to the case of Zodiac, there's a great debate about exactly how many victims he had and at what point he began laying claim to victims that were killed by someone else. It's interesting, though, that the phone call and letter came months before the crime. Another theory, which is as thin as the Zodiac claim, links the murder of Arliss Perry to an organization which is often the target of scrutiny and considered responsible for dark and vicious crimes, the Freemasons. There isn't a lot to go on here, but it's all in the symbolism. According to this theory, the arrangement of Perry's body was not to make a pentagram or a diamond, but to form the compass and square symbol which represents the Freemasons. Of course, while some have pointed this out as a direct sign that the Freemasons were involved, others have raised a logical question. Isn't it totally possible that someone posed the body this way to either implicate or insult the Freemasons? There isn't enough to go on with that theory, and it seems like something that came out of a result of trying to think of any possible reason for the death of Arliss Perry. Unfortunately, even the attempted connections to the Freemasons doesn't offer a motive, only a possible group behind the crime. Much like connections to satanic cults, the symbolism is certainly there, if you look at it the right way. But there's one final theory which attempts to look at things from a more open perspective. According to this theory, Perry was not murdered by a cult member or Satanists, but a sexually sadistic psychopath. Following this line of thought, Arliss Perry would arrive at the church around midnight. Two other individuals present in the church at that time exit and note another man entering. According to the security guard, Stephen Crawford, he looks over the church, finds no signs of anyone, and locks the doors. It seems apparent at this particular time, Crawford has gone and locked Perry in the church with her killer. And according to forensics, Perry is likely already dead or dying at the time this happens. It should be noted that Crawford would later run into trouble with the law, being arrested for stealing countless items from the Stanford campus over the years. Although he was cleared as a suspect in the murder, it does call into question his statements about his security duties and behaviors that night, and cast doubt on the idea that he thoroughly checked the church as he claims. Police theorize it's totally possible that the man who murdered Perry is a complete stranger to her, and either a sex criminal or mentally unstable person. Following her murder, the police worked hard questioning sexual deviants in the area, but came out with no leads or suspects with possible connections to the crime. Regardless, it's entirely possible that someone was either hiding in the church or entered it without being seen and murdered Arliss for no reason other than to do it. The posing of her body, the way he beat and strangled her before killing her, suggests a lot of different things. Predominantly, anger towards women and anger towards the church. Believe it or not, in the years surrounding Perry's murder, she was not an anomaly when it comes to victims found in or near the Stanford campus. Just 5 months before she was murdered, a 21-year-old named Janet Ann Taylor was found strangled near campus. The previous year, a Stanford junior named David Levine was stabbed to death in front of the Meyer Library. That same year, Leslie Marie Perlov was found strangled to death in the foothills behind campus. This has led some to theorize that Arliss Perry was not targeted by an individual, nor a victim based on any action of her own, but yet another senseless and frightening murder committed on or near the Stanford campus during this time period. It has been nearly 43 years since the body of Arliss Perry was found in Stanford Memorial Church in October of 1974. In that time, there have been many theories and suspects. We've seen links to the Son of Sam, and through him, connections made to a satanic church or cult, the Process Church. Through the church, we've connected William Mentzer, which in turn leads us to the possibility of the Zodiac Killer. All of these theories are complex, but require a great deal of leeway be granted to the paper-thin connections. Given the lack of any real developments over the years, little has been learned since the night when Arliss went to pray and never returned. It was a grisly crime, grotesque and blasphemous. For those who knew Arliss, it's a painful memory and a difficult thing to accept. Her husband, Bruce, moved back to North Dakota shortly after the murder and needed time to get past the trauma. In the years since, he's become a leading individual in the treatment of childhood trauma and has managed to turn his own pain into a guiding light for others. He doesn't speak much about his first wife. The memories are still too difficult to confront head on. Arliss was a sweet and innocent woman, devoted to her family, her husband, and her God. She deserved more, but was murdered in a senseless act of violence and used as a device to desecrate a church, while the church was used to desecrate her. It's a disturbing scene, and a hard thing to imagine. What makes it even more difficult is despite fingerprints, witnesses, and 43 years of investigation from law enforcement, private detectives, and curious reporters and citizens alike, we are no closer to answers today than we were on October 12, 1974. Oftentimes, in cases where there are no easy answers, people will try to make connections to bigger things, to more complex conspiracies and networks of criminals. Many times, in doing so, they lose track of the victim herself, and it becomes more about the scale of things than the person who perished. Arliss Perry should not be forgotten, nor shrouded in shadow by claims of satanic churches and infamous killers. Perhaps someday, there will be an answer, and Arliss Perry's name will become associated with justice, another cold case solved after many believed it impossible. Until then, we can only wonder who killed Arliss Perry, and why, if the Twisted Killer even had a reason. The murder of Arliss Perry is one of those crimes that doesn't seem real. It sounds more like something you'd read about in a horror novel, or see in one of those occult-styled movies about evil groups of people committing ritualistic killings. The idea that someone could do this to a woman is incomprehensible to me, and yet there are sick and twisted people out there in the world who do things like this all the time. It's hard to ignore the apparent symbolism of the crime, and it's even more difficult to shake the eeriness of it from your mind. It's even more disturbing when you come to grips with the idea that someone took a young, beautiful woman and used a sacred space as a torture room. Arliss was a devout Christian, and the church was to be her safe space, the place where she went to relax, to think things over, and to commune with her beliefs. Then a nameless man took her life, and used her body to mock her God, to taunt police, and to please himself. There's something about the way a body is treated post-mortem that's always gotten to me. In some ways, it disturbs me more than the crime itself. Most of us have lost a loved one, and you know that feeling you have at the funeral or the viewing. You want your loved one to be treated with dignity. You want them to be honored. When a criminal disrespects a body, either by posing it inappropriately or dismembering it, it shakes me to my core and it bothers me more than I can express. In the case of Arliss Perry, the idea that this sick man could strip her down, pose her, use items from the church to violate her, and then have masturbated to this disgusting scene is absolutely heinous and terrifying. I read a lot of cases every week, and in many ways, the one I choose jumps out at me. It hits me in some way, it speaks to me or calls out to me or just stays with me. When I read the account of Arliss Perry's murder, I couldn't get it out of my head. The amount of sympathy I felt for Arliss, as well as for her friends and family, was nearly overwhelming. As soon as I began typing my first words about the case, I found myself pulled in, and I simply couldn't stop. Maybe, in some way, I wanted the ability to try and honor her life in direct opposition to the way that she had been dishonored in her death. I don't know that I've accomplished that task, but it's important that we remember what happened to her and give her the attention that she deserves. I was startled by the lack of attention this case has gotten, especially considering the nature of the crime. This is the sort of thing that the media usually jumps all over. Maybe at the time it gained national attention, but I found out about it on an obscure website with lists of little covered crimes. There's a lot of forums and articles about possible links between the murder and the Zodiac Killer and the Son of Sam and the Process Church and satanic cults, but in many of those reports, Arliss herself is lost in the shuffle, and it's more about the theory and less about the victim. Sadly, this is often the case. In terms of the Son of Sam, most people knew the name of David Berkowitz, but have difficulty naming a victim. With the Zodiac, people remember the letters, the taunts, and the movies made about him, but not much else. In the case of Arliss Perry, most people have never even heard her name. Arliss was born in North Dakota, and never left until she was married and moving with her husband to Palo Alto, California. She was described by many as a sweet, kind woman who was way too trusting and believed there was good in everyone. Her own father stated that this was probably one of the issues which led to her murder, and it has been speculated that Arliss likely tried to talk to her killer and offer support before he committed the heinous crime. Her time in Palo Alto was just beginning to turn around. In the beginning, she'd written letters home talking about her loneliness. She made calls to friends and family members where she discussed how difficult it was to meet people in new places and how hard it was to be alone while Bruce was studying and working. It's been said that Arliss told one friend that she was so desperate that she considered going door to door and asking if anyone needed a friend. All of that began to change, though. Arliss got a job, she felt like she was contributing, and through her job, she was bound to meet a few people and find some friends. She was excited by the prospect, and her communications back to North Dakota became much more positive and optimistic. Sadly, just when things were looking up for her, it was all taken away. Arliss decided to mail some letters around 11 p.m., and Bruce went along with her. He didn't like Arliss walking around campus at night, and based on the fact that multiple murders occurred on or near the campus, it's understandable why. The two headed towards a post office drop box, and somehow got involved in an argument about the car's tire pressure. From everything I've read, this argument was about the tires being low, and each person accused the other one of being responsible for taking care of it. Following this argument, Arliss decided she needed to go to church to clear her mind and to be alone for a little while. Such a small argument that neither of them thought much about in the moments following it, and yet it was the last time the newlyweds would share together. According to the security guard, Stephen Crawford, he saw Arliss enter the church shortly before midnight, and when he went to lock up, he checked through the church to make sure no one was inside. I find this really hard to believe. There's no way that Crawford could have done a thorough check of the church and missed Arliss, let alone the man who would murder her. I fully believe that Crawford either didn't check the church at all and simply locked the doors, or that he just opened the door and yelled inside. If the murderer were in there with Arliss at this time, he could have either already murdered her or been holding her captive and told her to remain silent, or maybe even had his hand clasped over her mouth. If Arliss were still alive at this moment, she would have heard the guard calling in and been hoping desperately that he would come inside, but he never would. At this point in time, Crawford claims to have checked all the doors and found them locked. He then went back to his rounds, all the while Bruce was at home waiting for his wife to return. When she didn't come home, he began driving around campus looking everywhere for her. He went to the church and knocked on the doors. He called out her name. He'd become concerned that maybe she'd fallen asleep inside the church, but she never responded. According to the autopsy, at the time Bruce was knocking on the church doors and calling out her name, she was already dead inside. Police would arrive at the church shortly after 3 a.m., and they would find all the doors still locked. This means that while the police were there, and while Bruce was there, the murderer was still inside. It's during this time that he must have been posing her body or pleasuring himself. Crawford returned at 5:45 a.m. and found one of the doors forced open from the inside. This is the moment in which he made the discovery of Arliss's body. This means that the murderer was inside the church from midnight to at least sometime after 3 a.m. when the police checked all the doors. He could have left any time between approximately 3:30 a.m. and 5:45 a.m. So what was he doing in the church? We know that the killer stripped Arliss's body from the waist down, tore open her blouse, and posed her body. He violated her with church candles, and then masturbated on the kneeling pillow beside her. I've been wondering if forensic teams have ever publicly stated how much semen was found on the pillow, and whether or not they believe the killer masturbated more than once. Considering that he could have been in the church for several hours, I can't imagine that the posing of the body would have taken that long. Unless, of course, he posed her multiple times in multiple ways, attempting to get it just the way he wanted it. The entirety of the crime scene is disturbing. The idea of this vicious killer posing her body and pleasuring himself is sickening. The question is, why did he pose her the way he did? That's a question that's open to a lot of speculation. I can understand how people would assume it was ritualistic or linked to the occult in some way, but I don't necessarily agree. Arliss had been beaten, partially strangled, and then stabbed behind her left ear with a 5.5-inch long ice pick, which the killer left in her skull. To me, this doesn't feel like the act of someone who's executing a calculated act or ritual of sacrifice. It feels like an act full of rage. Whether or not words were spoken between Arliss and her killer, and whether or not she recognized him or knew him in some way, we simply don't know. But I'd have to believe she would have fought back. This might explain the beating and the strangulation, if it were used as a way to subdue her. But if so, why not finish her with the strangulation? Why bring out the ice pick? And of all the murder weapons to use, why an ice pick in the first place? The murder is shocking, and many police who were on the scene say it was one of the worst crime scenes they'd ever witnessed. They tried hard at the time to keep the details under wraps, but almost immediately there were rumors swirling about this being an occult crime, a ritual sacrifice, or a satanic assault. Despite their sincerest efforts, word leaked out, and eventually the press reported the details and the police had to respond to it. The more information that came to light, the bigger the theories became. We find people making connections to the Process Church and the possibility that a member of that organization followed Arliss from North Dakota with the intention of murdering her. The Son of Sam has his name thrown into the conversation, as does the Zodiac Killer. The Freemasons are accused of murdering her for some mysterious reason. Brian McCracken comes forward 40 years later with a theory about a flute player, and then there's the more mundane theory, as people call it, that Arliss was murdered in a random act of violence by a sadistic psychopath. The first theory I'll be examining is that the Process Church murdered Arliss Perry. The concept is that Arliss attempted to convert members of the Process to Christianity during her last year in Bismarck, North Dakota. It should be noted, the whole story that Arliss did this is based on the statements of one woman who's alleged to have been friends with Arliss during this period in her life. It seems like a bit of an overreaction for the Process to be so upset about a 19-year-old woman trying to convert members that they would hire someone or send one of their own members across the country to California to stalk and murder her. I can't pretend to have a full understanding of the mindset that people have when they're involved in a satanic organization and believe fully in its values and the concepts of black magic, but for me, this just doesn't make a lot of sense. The process has been linked to notorious individuals such as Charles Manson and David Berkowitz, people obviously prone to violence and murder, so it can't be completely ruled out, but neither Manson nor Berkowitz operated under the orders of the process. They were already disturbed individuals who found value in an organization that revolved around the darker side of things. Throughout my research, I haven't been able to link the process to any specific murders or actions such as these in the past or since. Both police and journalists have tried to link the process to violent activities, but were unsuccessful in establishing any real connections outside of rumor. Berkowitz would both acknowledge and then later deny being involved with the process. Manson was thought to have been involved, but later it was theorized that he had learned about the process and used some of their philosophies, but was never directly involved with it. So you have to wonder, what would be the point in murdering Arliss? I sincerely doubt that the process only ever had that one experience with someone trying to convert them. I don't believe they'd react by considering murder, and even if they did, I think once Arliss left town, they'd figure she was gone and they wouldn't have to deal with her again. If anything, I could see them threatening her or trying to intimidate her, but she hadn't done something to cause them irreparable damage, so murder would be a massively escalated response. In addition to that, Arliss was known to walk by herself around campus. She had a job she drove to every day by herself. If they wanted to murder her, they had ample opportunity before that night. It's entirely possible that a member of the church took it upon himself to strike out at her without the process being involved. I'm sure, based on people such as Berkowitz and Manson, that the organization attracted people with sick minds as much as they drew in more or less normal folks. That being said, it's completely worth considering that there were members who were likely to do this without needing the blessing of the process itself. If this was the case, though, whoever was responsible must have been capable of keeping his mouth shut, since no one has ever come forward with an accusation or evidence. I also believe if you're dealing with a member of this organization who has this kind of proclivity towards violence and murder, it's very hard to imagine that he would never do any other crimes. And we know he didn't, because his prints and DNA have never been matched, so they couldn't have been put into the system based on another crime. Although I understand the theory, I just don't believe that this is what happened here. Maury Terry, the former journalist and author of the book The Ultimate Evil, linked David Berkowitz to the crimes. It was his belief that Berkowitz was a member of the process, and later returned to New York, where he committed the Son of Sam murders as a direct result of his involvement with the church. He would go so far as to say that Berkowitz himself was involved in the murder of Arliss Terry, while investigators on the case would either say that Berkowitz knew the killer, or that Berkowitz was simply a liar. I've heard a great deal about Berkowitz being involved in cult activities and satanic worship, and I've read extensively on the theories that Berkowitz did not act alone when committing the Son of Sam murders. The problem with this is that, in all the years since, there's never been enough evidence raised to truly consider another suspect as a major possibility. Berkowitz decided in 1997 to place the blame on the Carr brothers, who were both dead at the time. It's oddly convenient that when he finally decides to name names, they're the names of two deceased men who can't defend themselves or controvert his theory. Berkowitz is a disturbed man who committed heinous acts for no reason. It's remarkably difficult to take his word on anything. He had been in prison for 20 years at the time he gave this interview, and had plenty of time to come up with alternative theories. When he was interviewed by police previously in relation to his writings about Arliss Perry, he didn't have a great deal to say. He didn't want to be involved, he didn't want to help, and he didn't want to make any connections for them. Berkowitz was a coward, stalking couples and lone women in the night. He shot them and ran. I don't believe he had the spine to commit this kind of up-close and personal murder that Arliss Perry suffered through. Whether or not Berkowitz knew the man responsible is debatable, but I sincerely doubt it. He may have heard whispers or rumors. Berkowitz always wanted to be more than he was, and what better way to do this than to insinuate himself into another major crime, or to fantasize connections to other major players in that wicked game. Outside of Berkowitz himself mentioning Arliss Perry, there have been no pieces of evidence which would link him to her, nor to ever even being in California at the time of her murder. Berkowitz is a galvanizing figure, and one who will forever be linked to murder in the occult. But outside of that, There's nothing I've seen sufficient enough for me to consider him a truly viable suspect in the murder of Arliss Perry. Through Berkowitz, we get the name of Manson II, which many people believe was William Mentzer, a former hitman for drug operations and a man currently serving life without parole for two separate murders. It's been supposed that he was involved in some way, shape, or form with the Processed Church, and it's even been put forth that he was the infamous Zodiac Killer. The list of possible suspects for the Zodiac Killer is a mile long, and to get on that list, a person doesn't have to have a great deal involved with the profile of the killer. From everything I've read, Mentzer is linked to the Zodiac because he was in California when the murders took place, is a sadistic and violent individual, and almost everything else is circumstantial. A prime example is this. The Zodiac stabbed two victims with a riveted bayonet-like knife, and Mentzer once worked manufacturing rivets and also carried a bayonet when he was in Vietnam. Seriously, these are the kinds of details which are used to link this man to the Zodiac Killer. Forget the fact that the police are in possession of a thumbprint and DNA they believe belong to the Zodiac, and Mentzer was almost certainly tested against these. I don't believe Mentzer is the Zodiac Killer, and from what I can tell, most of the people who do have been quiet about it for a long time now. Outside of Mentzer, there's still a theory that the real Zodiac, whoever he was, murdered Arliss Perry. We have the Zodiac letter where he discussed The Exorcist, a movie full of occult iconography and religious symbolism. Then the phone call, in which a caller claims to be the Zodiac and says he'd murdered someone in a church. Bear in mind, both the letter and the call take place 9 months prior to the murder of Arliss Perry. The letter doesn't mean much to me. Zodiac wrote about a lot of different things and sent them into the police. He enjoyed taunting and playing games with them, and if he'd actually done half the things he wrote about, he'd have been a much more prolific killer than he was. The phone call can't be verified. I can't find much information about it at all, and even if I knew for sure that the call had come in, there's no way of knowing that it was actually the Zodiac and not a prank caller. The entire scene of Arliss Perry's murder is outside of the Zodiac's MO. He wasn't a stalker and a hunter. He was random. He struck when the opportunity presented itself. In addition to this, Zodiac had never posed the bodies nor done anything even remotely sexual to them. He certainly never left behind semen at any of his murder scenes. I think putting Zodiac into the suspect list is simply a result of bizarre and baffling crime for which there are no easy answers, and Zodiac's a great scapegoat for these kind of things. It's not to say he couldn't possibly have done it, but at this particular point in time, I don't see anything that links him to it. Also, he'd have written letters taking credit for it. He did that with crimes he wasn't even responsible for, and the ability he'd have to taunt police following this murder would have probably been too much fun for his sick mind to ignore. Then there's the idea that the Freemasons were involved. The Freemasons tend to become boogeymen which are blamed for anything that appears to be occult-related. I'm certainly not going to say they haven't been involved in some darker stuff throughout the course of history, but the link here is almost impossible to see. Many have looked at the way Arliss's body was posed, and made a connection between the posing and the symbolism of the Masons, specifically the compass and the square. Photos of the crime scene have never been publicly released, so almost everyone is going off statements given by one or two people who saw the scene. I don't think the connection is there, and ultimately, I see no motive for the Freemasons, even if they were some dark and powerful organization, to randomly kill a 19-year-old newlywed in a church. If you've got some idea about how they could tie into this, please let me know, because I can't find anything. I've included it because it's out there, but for me, this is the most far-fetched theory in regard to the murder of Arliss Perry. Speaking of far-fetched theories, 40 years after the discovery of her body, Brian McCracken comes forward and claims he was in the church that night and saw the would-be killer. According to him, it was a known musician who was, at the time, in the Stanford Marching Band, a white man who wore a light-colored afro wig and played a flute. According to McCracken, he enters the church, sees the woman lying there naked, sees the man playing the flute, and leaves. Then, for 40 years, it simply slips his mind. Am I the only one that found this theory not only ridiculous, but insulting? I've walked in on people accidentally in a public bathroom before, and that stays with me. I'm fairly certain that if I'd walked in on a naked woman and an afro wig wearing flute player in a church near midnight, I'd probably remember that forever. It'd be one of those weird stories you tell your friends about this crazy thing you saw one time. I have a great deal of problems with this story, but predominantly, the facts don't line up. Crawford, the security guard, saw Arliss enter the church near midnight. Two witnesses leaving the church saw Arliss and an unidentified man entering after her. Crawford locked the church up at midnight. There doesn't appear to be a window of time at which McCracken would have walked into the church and seen what he alleges was going on. The church was locked within minutes of Arliss entering. Neither Crawford nor any other witness spot McCracken, nor report anyone playing a flute. I also think that since witnesses reported seeing a nondescript man with sandy hair who was around 5'10", they'd almost certainly remember a flute-playing man in an afro wig. I don't know what McCracken's drive was behind the statement, but it doesn't go anywhere. Police investigated it, and a former officer and McCracken himself pretended to be reporters to get information from the man, but that's it. It seems like a rather ludicrous theory, and I find it hard to believe anyone in law enforcement could have taken it seriously. It doesn't stand up to a comparison of the facts, and it doesn't have a basis in reality which can be established. It's interesting, and strange, and much like many of the theories in this case, it's definitely out there. But I can't find anything in it that makes any real sense or establishes any real links to the evidence. So there's one last theory. The idea that Arliss Perry's murder, though disturbing and spine-chilling, was the act of a single individual and was completely random. Some people have speculated that the ice pick being used as a weapon suggests the murder was premeditated. And while I can follow that line of logic, I feel that if someone were planning this murder, they would have chosen a knife or a gun and not an ice pick. You can certainly use an ice pick to kill, but if you're planning to kill someone, why wouldn't you choose a more logical weapon that's going to make it easier for you? I think it's possible that this man had an ice pick on him at the time, for reasons that could be endlessly speculated about, but I don't think this murder was necessarily premeditated. Considering the anti-religious symbolism and the posing of the body, I think it's possible that the killer either saw Arliss enter the church and decided on impulse to follow her in, or was inside already. There are several reasons that I don't think this was premeditated. One of these reasons is time. The crime took place at approximately midnight, and although someone could have been stalking Arliss, I think it's unlikely that the killer had the ability to follow her 24 hours a day. I also think that had she been followed, the presence of her husband would have scared the stalker off. In addition to this, if the crime were premeditated, it's unlikely that anyone could have known Arliss would enter the church that night. There would also be no way of knowing if anyone else would be present inside the church at that time, and as we've seen from the security guard Crawford, there was obviously some form of security, so to risk being caught committing the crime that close to closing is a very brazen act, and I don't think you would plan it out like that. Some churches close, and some don't. But in my experience, the ones that do have some kind of a sign or indication about the time that they lock up. I don't know if this is the case with Stanford Memorial Church, but either way, assuming the crime was premeditated, wouldn't it have made more sense to commit the crime on the dimly lit walk to the church or from the church rather than inside? I think it's highly possible that a transient or disturbed person was seeking shelter and was hiding in the church when he saw Arliss inside and decided to strike. The idea of the ice pick also feeds into this possibility, with it being the kind of thing someone could easily have found discarded or in a dumpster somewhere. It doesn't feel like the weapon of choice for an experienced killer. I believe the posing of her body suggests several different possibilities in terms of the suspect. Committing this crime within a church, and then posing her in a lewd way, I think this suggests issues with women and with the church itself. The police labeled the suspect as a sexual psychopath, and that's certainly possible. But I find it strange the killer would have masturbated to the scene and not have raped the victim himself. Technically speaking, he did. The insertion of the candle is considered sexual assault with a foreign object. But if this is the kind of thing that turned him on, why didn't he take it further? This is what makes me feel like sexual assault wasn't the intention of the murder, but that an act of committing the murder itself was what got the killer turned on. To me, it's so much more likely that this was a random act of violence, sick and twisted as it may have been. The posing was likely done as a way for the killer to revel in the scene and to mess with whoever would find the body. Since it took place in a church, it's possible that the killer believed that the body would be found by a member of the church or of the clergy, and he wanted to send a message. Of course, it's completely possible that the killer was deranged and mentally unstable, and that the entire scene and the murder itself was the result of those issues. We just don't know. But I think the idea of it being a random crime committed by a violently psychopathic person is very likely. Was that person the man who visited her at her job and the one who witnesses saw entering the church that evening? Police say they found that man and cleared him of any involvement in the crime. If that's true, that only leaves a total stranger to Arliss, or the possibility that police found and questioned the wrong man. Either way, to me, out of all the theories, a random act of violence from a sick individual feels much more likely than any other theory out there today. Arliss Perry died, and no answers were ever found as to who or why. Her family moved forward without her. Her husband returned to North Dakota, but eventually completed his studies and became a mental health professional. Some 43 years later, and we still know so little about the crime, and Arliss herself. An innocent victim of a heinous crime, the symbolism stays with you, and the scene is as haunting as it is confounding. Who murdered Arliss Perry? Evidence exists, and perhaps someday a match will be made to answer that question. Even if we find the who, the why will never make any sense. And if we ever do manage to find out exactly why this happened, I don't believe it's the kind of answer that will explain anything to someone with a mind that isn't as sick and twisted as the man who murdered her.
Case Update, Episode 10, The Bizarre Murder of Arliss Perry has been solved. As of today, Thursday, June 26, 2018, there has been breaking news regarding Arliss Perry's murder and the identification of the prime suspect. According to Sheriff Lori Smith of the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office, cold case detectives led by Detective Sergeant Rick Alanis had been working on Arliss's case. According to investigators, they had been looking at the case for some time and recently launched a retesting of the original DNA evidence. This time, their testing resulted in a strong enough link to a suspect that they were able to obtain a warrant. They had reached out to the suspect in recent weeks, performed interrogations, but had not received enough evidence for a concrete link. Thanks to their DNA testing, today, officers from the Sheriff's Department arrived at the Del Coronado Apartments, located on Camden Avenue in San Jose, to execute their newly gained search warrant. According to Sergeant Enrique Garcia, sheriff's deputies arrived at approximately 9:04 a.m., They spoke to the occupant of the apartment through the door, identifying themselves as sheriff's deputies. They then opened the door and entered the apartment, at which time they noted that the occupant and suspect was holding a handgun. Deputies immediately backed up, exiting the apartment, and moments later, they heard a single gunshot. Upon re-entering, they found the suspect deceased of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Sheriff Smith stated, quote, "He appears to have taken his own life," end quote. The San Jose Police Department took control of the scene, and the Sheriff's Department is treating it as an officer-involved shooting, as the suicide occurred while official Sheriff's Department procedures were being conducted. At this moment, the search through the apartment is ongoing, though delayed by the necessity to properly control the suicide scene and investigate the death. As of this afternoon, multiple news outlets reported that the apartment building's manager, Leticia Gonzalez, identified the decedent and suspect as Steve Blake Crawford, the security guard who initially reported finding Arliss's body back in 1974. As of a press conference at 5:30 p.m., the Sheriff's Department in Santa Clara County confirmed that identification and listed this case as officially closed and resolved, with Steve Blake Crawford as the murderer of Arliss Perry. Ruby Francisco, a neighbor of Crawford's, reported that he was a gray-haired man who appeared to be in his 70s. He was, in fact, 71. When building manager Gonzalez was asked about Crawford, she stated, quote, "He's a good guy, never had any problems. He kept to himself. All of us are shocked that this happened," end quote. She further described him as a well-dressed man who wore a cowboy hat and carried a cane. Crawford was reported to have moved into the studio apartment in 1993. Crawford faced legal trouble just 1 year before moving into the apartment in which he ended his life today. He had been arrested in 1992 under suspicion of having stolen nearly 300 rare books and pieces of art from Stanford University, where he had been working as a security guard. Over the years, Crawford was on the radar of investigators, though they never had enough information to label him as an official suspect to the public. There does appear to be some confusion, as it had been reported previously that Crawford had been tested against the evidence, but no link had been made. During the press conference, Sheriff Smith stated that he was never cleared through the testing of evidence. Of Crawford, Sheriff Smith stated, quote, "He had been a suspect in the case for many years, but we didn't have the evidence until now," end quote. When Smith was asked about the investigation, she responded, quote, "We have a cold case homicide unit, and they have been working this case actively since 1974. There's been a lot of increases in technology for DNA, and we were able to get more information that led us to believe that this was the suspect. That's why we were able to do the search warrant today," end quote. During the official Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department press conference, which took place at 5:30 p.m., Sheriff Smith made multiple statements in regard to the case and Crawford. When asked whether or not they knew for a fact that Crawford was in fact the killer, Sheriff Smith responded, "This is a case that eludes us no longer." When asked about Arliss Perry, Smith responded, "Her life and this case had value." When asked how it made her feel solving this case after 40 years, she responded, "It's difficult for her family, it was difficult for the department, but we finally have closure in this case." The detectives had continually gone through the evidence, submitted additional evidence for testing. There was no DNA testing at the time of the murder, of course. Sheriff Smith specified that the DNA used to connect Crawford to the murder was taken from an item of Arliss's clothing. When asked point blank what had cleared Crawford in the past, she responded, quote, "Nothing ever cleared him. There was just not enough evidence to charge him with a crime," end quote. She went on to explain that Crawford knew he was a person of interest and that investigators had been reaching out to him actively. When asked whether or not Arliss Perry knew Crawford, Sheriff Smith responded, quote, "I don't think we have any evidence at this time that they knew each other," end quote. When asked about the possibility that Crawford may have committed other unsolved crimes, she responded, quote, "Not that we're aware of now, but we're continuing to follow up," end quote. According to Sheriff Smith, family members have been notified of the resolution of this case, and they were appreciative of that notification. There will be another press conference tomorrow in which further information will be released. So finally, after 44 years, this horrendous and gruesome crime has been solved, and Arliss Perry's murderer has been identified as former security guard Steve Blake Crawford. When I covered this case back in episode 10, there was certain information available at the time which resulted in the theories being a little off. For the past 44 years, the consensus in the media has been that Steve Crawford had been tested against the known evidence and that because there were no matches, he had been ruled out. Sheriff Smith has made it clear that while not enough evidence existed for an arrest, he was never cleared. When I covered this case, I felt that Crawford's story was bizarre. I didn't necessarily think he'd committed the crime, but I didn't understand how he could have checked the church, as he alleged, and not noticed that Arliss and her would-be killer were inside. Now it makes sense, since it seems that the man himself was the killer, and his lack of credibility in his story was due to his involvement in the crime. Looking at the crime, there are several aspects of it which result in me believing that there's more to this story we may learn in the future. The murder was brutal. The sexual assault was horrifying. The posing was lewd and disgusting. Is it possible that Crawford committed this crime, having never committed others, and then went the rest of his life without murdering or sexually assaulting anyone else? Yeah, but it seems unlikely. I find it difficult to accept that this was the only crime he ever committed. The psychopathy present here certainly points to a disturbed individual. Crawford was a security guard, watching over the church and campus, and as such had access to campus and the building when others did not. Knowing how many sexual assaults take place on college campuses and fail to get reported, I can't help but wonder if additional investigation will tie Crawford to other crimes which have been unsolved. DNA is becoming a huge thing lately in terms of solving cases. We've all been joyful about the Golden State Killer case being broken, and we're seeing more and more of that happening. Just today, I was reading about additional DNA work being done in the Molly Bish case. I'm hopeful that as we progress further and technology advances, that we'll see many of the unsolved cases that have haunted us for so many years solved. In Arliss Perry's case, in total honesty, I considered it unlikely that we were going to see this case solved. It's been 44 years, and the likelihood was low. But thanks to the hard work and determination of the Cold Case Homicide Unit working in the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department, today, this horrible crime has been given a resolution. Unfortunately, we may never know for certain what happened that night due to Crawford committing suicide as the police were at his door. While it sickens me to imagine that this horrible person was able to walk free and do God knows what else for the past 44 years, I'm comforted in knowing that he's gone from this world. While it was a coward's way out, rather than facing justice, he's been outed as a brutal and violent man whose name will forever be linked to this terrible event, though hopefully his name will fade from memory. For Arliss's family and loved ones, I hold out hope that while this answer cannot bring her back, nor answer the haunting question of why, perhaps now knowing who was responsible will grant them some modicum of closure and peace. The resolution of this case opens doors to many other possibilities. Other potential victims, other cold cases to which Crawford may have been connected. However, it also grants us a light of hope. So many of the cases I cover feel as though they'll never be solved. So many of the victims I've profiled seem unlikely to be found or to receive justice. And yet each day we get closer and closer, with more cases being cracked and more answers being supplied. I work in the business of the unsolved, and I can say with certainty, were I to be put out of business and all these cases find their answers, I'd be incredibly happy to close up shop. Thank you so much for listening to this update. If you haven't heard my coverage of the case, make sure you go back and check out episode 10, The Bizarre Murder of Arliss Perry, which I will now be able to add this update to the end of and list the case as solved. Subscribe, rate, and review. Visit me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, join the Facebook discussion group by searching for Trace Evidence, and visit the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to send a special thank you to Laura, host of The Fall Line, for bringing this update to my attention earlier today. Hopefully, this will be the first of many of these cases being solved. I want to thank you for listening to Trace Evidence, and I'll see you next week with another unsolved case.